Before monetary policy is factored in, deflation is the natural order of a productive economy. If we are using a hard money standard, like gold, for example, we would expect products to get cheaper over time relative to the value of our gold and money, thanks to technological and productivity improvements over time, which make them cheaper relative to the number of labor hours required to produce them. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the show. This is Bitcoin Audible. I am the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know, and my name is Guy Swan. We are hitting part two today. This is part two of continuing yesterday's read by Lynn Alden on QE, MMT, and the inflation, deflation, a primer on inflation and deflation. And it's a really, really great piece. If you haven't listened to yesterday's episode, she really lays down the framework for the different models of government spending, of deficit spending, of monetizing debts, of creating money in the economy, et cetera, and then basically takes that framework to project out and make some sort of sense of the future that we could see in the dollar environment and where the U.S. economy and the maybe even the dollar reserve currency could find itself in regards to expected inflation and deflation in the future. And I really love the concept of the opening quote, and I didn't actually hit it much in the guy's take on this one, but this is something that's so misunderstood, is that the natural state of an economy that's producing and growing is deflation. And I think so much of quote-unquote inflation is missed or completely unrealized exactly what that impact is when the Federal Reserve or the government is trying to target 2% inflation, how actually destructive that is to the economy just on its face, when the natural state of the economy, and we have so many of these technological deflationary forces that Lynn Alden will talk about in today's piece, that would actually be increasing the value of our money. That if we grow by 3 or 4% because the economy is more productive, that it's more valuable, it is explicitly the wage earners. It is explicitly those who are the most productive and have saved the most in the economy that would benefit from that. So if the Federal Reserve is targeting 2% inflation, nominal inflation in the dollar prices of goods, and we're in an economy that has had 4% growth in productivity, they're stealing 6%. They're stealing the extra 40% of our productivity, the things that we have explicitly earned and built and made as positive value into the economy, and then targeting another 2% on top of that. And I'll just let Lynn Alden get into all the ins and outs and all the different forces and why sometimes it's isolated in certain areas of the economy and not others, et cetera, et cetera. This part two, the inflation-deflation debate, is really good and is just packed with information. So real quick, shout out to our two amazing sponsors for Bitcoin Audible, Swan Bitcoin, the place to automatically buy and stack your Bitcoin. Low fees, automatic. You set it once and you forget about it. It just runs. I've been stacking the whole time. I never even touch it unless I want to go up there and I just smash buy on a dip. And then, of course, I withdraw it to my Bitbox hardware wallet, Bitbox O2 from Shift Crypto. It is an open source hardware wallet to secure your keys and know without a doubt that you own your Bitcoin. And in an increasingly uncertain financial environment and ecosystem, it is a crucial thing for getting some sound sleep. Check out both of our amazing sponsors at guyswan.com. With that, let's go ahead and get into part two of Lynn Alden's piece. And it's titled, Part 2, The Inflation-Deflation Debate. There are different definitions of inflation, but for everyday people, what matters is consumer price inflation. In other words, how much does an apple cost today compared to what it cost last year or 5 years ago? if an apple gets more expensive, it could be because the apple itself went up in value. For example, if a crop disease destroys 95% of all apple production this year and apples become in unusually short supply, and thus only affordable to apple enthusiasts, the price of apples would increase versus other food items. Alternatively, it could be because the currency becomes inherently weaker for buying things in general. For example, we printed a ton of dollars over the years with inflationary monetary policy, so it takes more dollars to buy a bushel of apples today than it took your grandparents to buy the same bushel decades ago. Not because of apple scarcity, but because of currency devaluation. If we use a basket of goods, we have a better indication about whether the currency itself is weakening, because we factor out unusual supply limitations of certain goods, such as apple crop diseases. Whether monetary and fiscal policies result in significant consumer price inflation or not depends on where the money is spent, the magnitude of that spending, or what other inflationary or deflationary forces are occurring to fight with or against it, and whether people have confidence in the soundness of the currency. And inflation plays a huge role in equity, bond, real estate, and commodity pricing. So having a range of outcomes for inflation in the years ahead is useful for long-term investors. Why so little inflation in the 2010s? Many investors feared that the QE performed from 2008 to 2014 would cause consumer price inflation, but for the most part, it did not. Here's the official inflation rate over the long run. Prior to that point, QE had not really been performed since the 1940s, the end of the previous debt supercycle, so it was a new variable for most investors to figure out. People differ on how much they trust the official consumer price inflation estimates. There are many ways that the official numbers can understate actual inflation, especially including A, product substitutions, and B, a mismatch in ratios for what the average household actually spends its money on in weighted terms. In other words, the basket of goods that the government uses to measure inflation includes substitutions when certain items get too expensive, and may or may not be an accurate representation of the basket of goods that a typical consumer buys to support a decent lifestyle. However, it's pretty clear for a broad basket of goods and services, ranging from apples to televisions to car repair services, that inflation has not been very high. The prices for some things like healthcare, consumables, and education have gone way up, but for other things like electronics, software, and commodities, prices have gone way down. And it's region-dependent. The cost of living in San Francisco has risen faster than living in a suburb in Heartland America, for example. Broad money supply, M2, per capita increased by an annualized rate of about 5% from the beginning of 2008 to the beginning of 2020. Official consumer price inflation only increased by an annualized rate of about 1.6% during that time frame, although it is more or less in various cities. I think there's a credible argument that the actual cost of living increased faster than that, but probably not quite at the 5% rate of per capita money supply increase. So trillions of new dollars were created on an absolute basis and a per capita basis with limited effect on many prices. This is unintuitive to many, but there are several reasons for this. Technology is deflationary. Technology gives us greater and greater access to products and services with less cost. For example, imagine how many expenditures your smartphone replaces. No more paid long-distance calls, buying cameras, or buying a CD player with CDs, and it allows for fewer trips to your physical bank via mobile banking, and probably less expenditure on other sources of entertainment, such as watching free YouTube rather than a paid TV service. It's a pocket supercomputer filled with countless software tools. My mediocre television, bought in 2019, is equivalent to one of the best televisions on the market in 2009, and way better than the best television in 1999 for a fraction of the cost. Offshoring is deflationary. Hiring cheaper labor from less developed parts of the world to build a lot of our products and services is cheaper than paying our own citizens, with higher hourly rates, more expensive healthcare coverage, and more environmental and safety regulations at the workplace to make those products and services and helps reduce the cost. This, of course, has ramifications down the road, especially for the working class whose jobs are more affected. But while it's happening, it's a deflationary force. Onshoring is deflationary. Sometimes we don't send jobs overseas, but instead we bring foreign labor to us. The U.S. agriculture industry, for example, is supported by cheap, legal, and illegal immigrant workers. In other words, the cost of an apple hand-picked from a legal or illegal immigrant working under the table or even above the table is lower than the cost of an apple hand-picked from someone that has medical insurance and makes $15 an hour. Again, this has other ramifications, but it's deflationary. Unprofitable businesses are deflationary. An era of low interest rates has made capital cheap. The hurdle rate for lending it or investing it is low, so investors and banks have been willing to provide equity and debt financing to businesses with no plans to be GAAP profitable for a very long time, like Tesla, Uber, and so forth. Even fast-growing Netflix is free cash flow negative year after year and literally issues junk-rated debt to fund new content. As long as the stock price keeps going up, investors are happy and executives get paid in these unprofitable business models. And as long as companies have not had to make a profit on the products and services, even after a decade or more in operation, the prices of their products tend to be cheaper than they would be in a funding scenario that requires them to make a profit. Bear markets eventually test investor patience for structurally unprofitable businesses if stock price appreciation is the only source of financial payback. Cheap commodity prices are deflationary. We haven't had much commodity scarcity over the past decade because we had a large commodity development cycle that peaked in 2012, resulting in oversupply for many commodities that has persisted for nearly a decade. We've had an abundance of commodities with modest ongoing input costs to get those commodities, thanks to large investments a decade ago. In addition, cheap capital has allowed for growing shale oil production, despite many of the companies never generating consistent free cash flow or paying dividends. Investors in those businesses have basically provided cheap oil as a charity, albeit unintentionally. We thank them for their service. Wealth concentration is deflationary. If you take $1 trillion and give 100 million middle-class people each $10,000, they will spend a lot of it and it'll have an inflationary jolt on consumer prices. In other words, the velocity of that money will be high because it goes to people with a big divide between what they want and need and what they have. However, if you take $1 trillion and instead give 100 multi-billionaires each $10 billion, their spending patterns are unlikely to change nearly as much, which would not provide a consumer price jolt. The velocity of that money would be very low. They already have everything they want. They will likely invest that extra money into financial assets. The difference between what they want and need and what they have is non-existent. They'll stick it in the bank, buy bonds, buy stocks, buy another mansion or yacht, and so forth. Financial asset prices are what would see inflation in this scenario, and likely some high-end luxuries like fine art and yachts, not consumer prices for paper towels or apples or Honda cars. Lower asset prices are deflationary. For a middle-class person, their home equity and retirement account represents most of their wealth. In fact, with home equity loans or cashing out a 401k account during a job change, they can even tap into these assets for consumer spending. In the aftermath of 2008, housing and equity prices collapsed, which wiped out a lot of spending power, and it took years to recover. The initial jolt of money creation from QE was offset by deflating asset prices. Debt defaults are deflationary. When a person or company defaults on loan or bond and is unable to pay, that loan or bond becomes worthless or severely impaired, and that is someone else's asset. In a credit-based system, most money is actually credit, which is a highly leveraged form of money. So when credit is destroyed, it's basically a destruction of money. Deleveraging is a deflationary event, even if ultimately a healthy one. Household debt as a percentage of GDP reached a peak of 100% in 2009, but gradually fell to about 75% in the following years as people walked away from mortgaged homes that they couldn't afford. Aging demographics are deflationary. For most people, their peak spending years are their middle years, when they are raising a family. As they age into their golden years, many of them downsize their property and spend less money elsewhere. They do spend more on healthcare, and healthcare prices have risen faster than the broad inflation rate. The United States and most other developed nations have increasingly high median ages and lower fertility rates, which presents a deflationary background force on the economy for many types of products and services outside of healthcare and some other key areas. When a population is older and slower growing, or even outright shrinking, as is the case with Japan, it takes a lot longer for demand to outpace supply whenever there is a supply glut, which pushes prices down. Trade surpluses are deflationary. The United States doesn't have this, but Japan and some European countries do. When a country consistently produces more than it consumes, and thus develops a positive trade balance and particularly a positive current account balance, it means more wealth is flowing into that country each year than is flowing out. This gives a currency a tendency to appreciate in price, which is deflationary. I covered a detailed Japanese example for this in my article, How to Win a Currency War. So, this newly created money from QE in 2008-2014 went up against several deflationary forces. It has been offset by rapidly improving technology, labor offshoring, businesses with no apparent mandate to be profitable, a lack of commodity scarcity, wealth concentration, debt defaults, and aging demographics. In other developed countries, their QE efforts have also been offset by positive trade balances and current account balances. Before monetary policy is factored in, deflation is the natural order of a productive economy. If we were using a hard money standard like gold, for example, we would expect products to get cheaper over time relative to the value of our golden money, thanks to technological and productivity improvements over time, which make them cheaper relative to the number of labor hours required to produce them. However, monetary authorities and fiat currency frameworks counter that deflationary trend with a consistent inflationary response, so that most monetary systems experience mild inflation over time. The Federal Reserve targets 2% inflation per year on average. The magnitude of QE from 2008 to 2014, despite being in the trillions, wasn't that dramatic in the grand scheme of things. The Federal Reserve's balance sheet went from $900 billion to $4.5 trillion, meaning that about $3.6 trillion in new dollars were created and then either lent to the U.S. government for spending or put into the mortgage market to buy mortgage-backed securities to recapitalize the financial system, effectively out of thin air. A portion of this $3.6 trillion found its way into the hands of everyday citizens living on Main Street. Some of it supported government spending, as discussed in Part 1, including existing entitlement spending and extra stimulus efforts. This was less than $2 trillion. Other portions of it, over $1.7 trillion, just supported the financial system by bailing out the mortgage industry and, consequently, asset prices. Total household net worth of the United States dropped from $71 trillion in 2007 to $60.3 trillion in 2009, representing a decline of $11 trillion in household wealth, and took until 2012 to get household wealth back to the highs of 2007. So the $3.6 trillion in totally new dollars for QE that came out of the Fed's void and injected into the economy was small compared to this total initial base of existing wealth, $71 trillion, and small compared to the amount of paper wealth that had recently been lost, $11 trillion. The new money just offset a part of what was otherwise a large deflationary shock. Even when asset prices ultimately recovered and the deflationary shock side of the equation started to go away, it was a gradual process, and a lot of the benefit of the recovery went to us in the top 10% that own financial assets. In the 1990s, the top 10% richest households owned about 60% of the country's household net worth. By 2006, it had increased to 65%. By the end of 2019, it was over 70%. Meanwhile, the share of wealth held by the bottom 90% of households decreased from 40% of the country's household net worth in the 1990s to 35% in 2006 to less than 30% at the end of 2019. Overall, the top 1% of households currently own nearly a third of total U.S. wealth, and wealth concentration was occurring before and after QE due to increased financialization of markets, offshoring, changes in fiscal policy, and other factors. So this trend was in place prior to QE. QE didn't cause it, although it didn't help either, in the way it was spent during the 2008-2014 period. Rapid consumer price inflation occurs when a ton of new currency is created. That currency gets to everyday citizens through one channel or another, and they spend it on a finite pool of products and services, and thus bid up the prices more and more. This can start a vicious cycle where money is perceived to be quickly losing its value, so people want to spend it on something durable as soon as they get it, which can further pull forward future demand and exacerbate the shortage of products and services relative to how much new money is in the system, and the desire to spend that money on those products and services. This is not what we saw over the past decade. The everyday household is cash-strapped. They haven't been flooded with liquidity. They lost home equity and 401k values after the 2008 and 2009 crisis. Then were given a bit of a stimulus. Their home values and investments slowly recovered, and their wages have been rising at a slow rate, with much of it eaten up by rapidly rising healthcare and education costs. The median American household has very limited cash savings. For Americans receiving Social Security, Medicare, or other government payouts, part of it was funded due to money printing via QE, but this just maintained their existing payout promises. Average wages didn't change much over that period. Wages were growing at a 3 to 3.5% annual rate prior to the recession, and then fell to under 2% per year, and eventually climbed their way back up to 3 to 3.5% by the end of the business cycle. Officially, consumer price inflation went up for certain areas, particularly healthcare, education, and some consumer disposables. Those things are rather essential, generally aren't outsourced, and technology hasn't been applied to make them much cheaper, arguably better, but not cheaper. This was partially offset by price deflation in electronics, software, consumer durables, vehicle parts, Walmart products, and so forth that have benefited from outsourcing to cheaper regions of the world and technological improvements that have greatly reduced their prices. So, the amount of QE in 2008-14 was small compared to the total household net worth and small compared to the amount of household net worth that was lost in the years during the time that QE occurred. And even among that small amount of new dollars, only a portion of it got down to Main Street in the form of government spending, and especially to the older side of Main Street rather than the younger side. Very little of the money got to the younger side of Main Street. And the rest propped up the mortgage market and helped recapitalize banks by offsetting debt defaults and was offset by some deflationary trends. It was more inflationary for financial assets than consumer prices. Modeling inflation in the 2020s. We're currently experiencing another huge deflationary shock from the impact of COVID-19 on a highly leveraged global financial system, as many people have lost incomes and asset prices have fallen, but large fixed debts remain, expecting payment. This is a multi-trillion dollar reduction in U.S. household net worth from peak to trough again, although we don't know the precise number yet. Countering that shock is the government and central bank's QE-funded inflationary response. The U.S. federal government passed a crisis bill to inject $2.2 trillion into the economy, followed by another nearly $500 billion more recently, totaling about $2.7 trillion, and we're only 3 months into this. Because foreigners and most domestic pools of capital are not able to accumulate $2.7 trillion in treasury securities, this is being funded by new money creation, aka QE by the Federal Reserve, as described earlier in this article. In addition, with a special purpose vehicle between the Treasury and the Federal Reserve, they can make business loans and buy corporate bonds as well. So far, the Federal Reserve has increased its balance sheet by over $2.5 trillion by buying Treasury securities, mortgage-backed securities, and other assets with newly created dollars. This increase in the balance sheet will likely be $6 trillion or more by the end of the year, up to $10 trillion for the balance sheet in total from its starting point of about $4, and more than that in the several years ahead. Will these ever be unwound from the Fed's balance sheet, or just forever rolled into new maturities like what happened after 2008? Almost certainly the latter. Japan, the European Union, the United States, and other central banks never really unwind their QE. Current deflationary shock. In 2020, deflationary forces are in charge for most product categories. Cars and other durable goods, luxuries, clothing, electronics, commodities, commercial real estate, rents, and capital goods. These are firmly a buyer's market in such a low-demand environment. These things have plenty of supply and few buyers, which means low prices. Sellers of discretionary items need to offer big price discounts to make sales. Complicating this situation is that we have a supply shock as well, unlike most recessions. Production and supply chains are impacted, and demand or hoarding tendencies have increased for certain categories of goods. This can be inflationary in targeted areas if not corrected. We're starting to see inflation in grocery store prices, because that's the one key area where we are still all spending money at a time when production and supply chains have issues. So in the near term, we have a broad deflationary trend for discretionary spending categories, but potential inflation in essential spending categories. In addition, there's a giant debt overhang. The United States went into this crisis with total debt, government, corporate, and household, equal to about 350% of GDP, or $75 trillion in absolute terms, which is a very deflationary force. We began the 2008 crisis with about a 350% debt-to-GDP ratio as well. As businesses and consumers deleverage, either through bankruptcy, debt payoff, or facing stricter credit requirements from banks to get lending, it puts more downward pressure on demand and discretionary prices, because even as money supply increases, overall spending power from credit and leverage decreases. Even before this crisis, broad money velocity was on the decline. Wealth was concentrated and money was not moving around much. This crisis further amplifies that trend. Longer-run inflation potential. In the years ahead, the possibility for broad inflation is back on the table. As pandemic lockdowns ease and ongoing government stimulus tries to get the economy back up off the floor, consumer demand can increase while the new money supply remains in the system. The timeline on which this happens depends on how much stimulus and consumer business support the combo of the Treasury and Federal Reserve prints up and hands out to Main Street, and how fast the virus goes away, enough such that restaurants, hotels, airlines, concerts, events, and other gatherings can partially and then completely reopen. Over the multi-year longer run, if we see a trend towards bringing a portion of our supply chains back to the U.S., that could further raise inflationary pressures because it would start to undo one of the major deflationary outlets, offshoring, that has been in place for decades. For those decades, we've optimized efficiency over resiliency, which means lower prices. But in the decades ahead, domestication and resiliency are likely to play a more important role, which means higher prices. In addition, we could likely see a recovery in commodity prices as demand and supply balance themselves out. However, it's important to quantify it, not just talk in qualitative terms. If someone speaks of hyperinflation next year or deflation forever, ask them to show you their work. A baseline debt and inflation outlook. Here's a baseline starting point, and readers can change it to accommodate their own assumptions as they wish. At the end of 2019, total U.S. household net worth was over $118 trillion. U.S. GDP was just under $22 trillion, and U.S. broad money supply was about $15 trillion, as reported by the St. Louis Fed with sources to the relevant agencies that collect those statistics. The Fed's balance sheet ended 2019 a bit over $4 trillion. That's our starting baseline, rounded. Equity prices are down for now in this crisis, and home equity in some regions could be down as well in the years ahead, so some asset-based wealth was lost. Almost $11 trillion in U.S. equity wealth was wiped away from the Wilshire 5000 full-cap U.S. equity market from peak to trough in quarter one of 2020. Although as of this writing, we've partially rebounded from those lows. Foreign equity also lost value. Home values changed more slowly. We don't know the full scope there yet. Cash, treasury securities, gold, and the safest corporate bonds held up well. For every 5% of the $118 trillion in U.S. household net worth that was or will be lost in this crisis from peak to trough, that would be $5.9 trillion in wealth wiped away. Unemployment is extremely high and will take an unknown time to recover, so consumer confidence will be shaken for a while. This lost wealth and income are largely deflationary shocks. Lending will also be tight for a while, except for markets where the government decides to intervene. J.P. Morgan Chase, for example, now requires credit scores over 700 and 20% down for a mortgage. Wells Fargo is no longer accepting applications for home equity lines of credit. These types of stricter lending requirements slow down the expansion of credit. And that expansion of credit is an important point. It's not just the amount of money and goods or services in the system that governs inflation, rising prices for those limited goods and services. Consumer spending power is in large part fueled by access to and expansion of credit. Banks take deposits and then multiply that money into loans. Consumers get income and then buy more than their income can immediately provide, thanks to mortgages and other debt. If leverage remains static or decreases, it means that base money is not multiplying as much, and consumers are living more in their means in terms of spending, and some are deleveraging or defaulting. Broad money velocity is a measure of GDP divided by the broad money supply. It measures how swiftly those dollars move around the system and get spent and re-spent, which tends to boost inflation, rather than get accumulated and saved, which doesn't. Broad money velocity has decreased to extreme lows in recent years, down to a little over 1.4x before the COVID-19 crisis and under 1.4x by the end of quarter one 2020. So we went into this virus crisis with low money velocity to begin with, and an unknown amount of wealth was destroyed depending on which time period you use and how much home equity net worth ends up being affected. GDP is decreasing while the broad money supply is still growing, so the velocity is sharply declining during the crisis in quarter two of 2020. On the other hand, the Fed's balance sheet is expected by many estimates to expand from $4 trillion to $10 trillion this year, and is already up to $6.7 trillion within 2 months of the crisis, and is still growing at a swift rate. If we reach a $10 trillion balance sheet this year compared to the $4 trillion that the Fed came into the year with, that will be $6 trillion in new capital injected into the economy in the form of fiscal spending that was spent but not extracted. See the QE examples from part one above. and in terms of private bonds being bought with new dollars and stored on the Fed's balance sheet, which recapitalizes the financial system with new dollars. Would $6 trillion in new capital lead to massive inflation this year, in the face of such a deflationary shock and wealth destruction? Probably not. This money printing would counteract some of the deflationary shock of so much debt and lost spending and income, but not necessarily spur a lot of new inflation right away, other than for the possibility of very targeted supply chain disruptions related to food, cleaning supplies, virus protection equipment, and other essentials. What if the Fed boosts its balance sheet to $15 or $20 trillion by the end of next year or the year after? Meaning it injects $11 to $16 trillion into the system from its starting balance sheet of $4 trillion. Particularly if a significant portion of that is to finance crisis-level helicopter checks, extended unemployment benefits, and other Main Street expenditures by the government. Well, now we're talking large numbers, and the possibility for intermediate-term inflation is more on the table. Not hyperinflation, but inflation. We're already seeing the largest year-over-year percent growth in broad money supply in modern history. But outside of essentials like groceries and healthcare, that money isn't moving around yet, with velocity extremely low. The years ahead. It's the next few years in the future where we really need to think about broad inflation after so much aggressive policy response and expansion of the money supply. Over 30 million people lost their jobs over the past 2 months. Many of these can come back sharply whenever restaurants, hotels, airlines, casinos, and other places start to come back online. But several million of them will likely take quite a long time to come back. It took over 6 years for the number of employed people to get back above its previous high after the 2008 financial crisis, as a baseline example. And we went into this crisis with more wealth concentration and more consumer credit as a percentage of GDP than ever before. The bottom 50% of Americans have very little safeguards against total insolvency. Specifically, the bottom 50% of Americans collectively have only 1.5% of the country's household net worth, which is down from 4% in the 1990s. Their assets and liabilities are nearly equal, resulting in a very low average net worth, and they are highly dependent on active income streams, and many of those income streams are now shut off. The federal government could very well find itself between a rock and a hard place. Support these people financially with QE-funded helicopter money, checks and/or extended unemployment benefits, or face rising prospects of social unrest from people that can't pay rent and have no job, and thus not much to lose. So I somehow doubt that the $1,200 check and extra unemployment benefits will be enough to keep things smooth by the end of the year and through next year and the year thereafter. More checks are likely coming. If so, these would be funded by QE, meaning money that is created out of thin air and makes it to Main Street via the Federal Reserve buying treasuries that support those payouts. This type of QE would make it to Main Street much more directly and obviously than the smaller portions of prior rounds of QE that only partially made it to the people. Remember, the U.S. government went into this crisis with $1 trillion in annual deficits, or deficits equal to 5% per GDP and rising. Normally, during market expansions, the government deficit narrows, but this time, it was already rising prior to the crisis. This was due to worsening demographics followed by an unfunded tax cut. Medicare and Social Security are becoming more and more top-heavy in terms of the number of people getting benefits versus the number of people paying into the system, as the baby boomer generation started to enter peak retirement years. And this is projected to get worse. According to the Census Bureau, the percentage of the U.S. population over the age of 65 will increase from 17% to 21% from 2020 to 2030. This was an atypical deficit expansion as a percentage of GDP during a period of low employment, normally only seen during active wars. And as previously described earlier in this article, the government had run out of natural buyers for that debt, both domestic and foreign, and so the Federal Reserve began funding it with new dollars in 2019. So the combination of the Treasury and the Federal Reserve is injecting a 5% annualized rate of the country's GDP of new money into the economy in an MMT-like situation right before we found ourselves in this virus crisis. Going forward, the United States has a structural rising 5% deficit and then some combination of crisis intervention, already projected to be $2.7 to $4 trillion or more this year, or 12 to 18% of GDP, and potential stimulus, infrastructure renewal, and continued checks and so forth going forward in the years ahead, on top of that 5% baseline. After this year, with a deficit of 20-plus percent of GDP, there is a decent probability of several years of fiscal deficits of 10% or more of GDP, and mostly funded by new money from the Federal Reserve. That's $4 or more trillion this year, and $2 trillion or more per following year for a while after that in new money injection into the economy. As a comparison, we can look at how the federal deficit was affected in the 2008 crisis. In 2007, the federal government had an official deficit of a little over 1% of GDP. In 2008, it expanded to over 3% of GDP. The year 2009 was the big one, where the deficit roughly hit 10% of GDP. Then in both 2010 and 2011, the deficit was over 8% of GDP. By 2012, it was still over 6%. And then by 2013, it was down to 4% of GDP and eventually bottomed in 2015 and 16 at below 3% of GDP before starting to rise again. The actual increase in debt as a percentage of GDP was higher than official deficits in most years. Many items are off the balance sheet. And it's not just extra spending. The deficits during 2008-13 came from both extra spending and a decrease in tax revenue. Specifically, the federal government lost nearly $500 billion, or one-fifth of its annual revenue from peak to trough in the recession, and it didn't get back to its 2007 level of tax receipts until 2012. As a result of increased spending and decreased tax receipts from the start of 2008 to the start of 2013, total federal debt as a percentage of U.S. GDP increased from 64% to 101% as these large federal deficits accumulated into federal debt. By the end of 2019, the U.S. government had inched up to total federal debt at 106% of GDP. That's our starting point for this recession, before the COVID-19 crisis started. Deficits will likely exceed 20% of GDP in 2020. A 5% baseline deficit plus perhaps 20% combined crisis spending and tax revenue reduction. So we could be looking at federal debt of around 125 to 130% of GDP or more by the end of 2020. And then, if we have 3 years of 10% deficits in 2021 to 2023, it pushes the ratio to potentially 140 to 160% of GDP, mostly funded by the Federal Reserve with new money. This could represent $10-plus trillion in new money injected into the economy. I consider this a lower-end estimate. If more municipalities and pensions are bailed out by the federal government, if student loans held by the government are forgiven, or if helicopter money to the public stays for a while, or if massive infrastructure stimulus is funded, the projected deficits in this model have a higher potential ceiling. With all of this money printing likely to occur over the next several years, the possibility for consumer price inflation becomes a matter of money velocity and confidence in the dollar. Putting more than $10 trillion in new capital into a country with $118 trillion in total starting household net worth and $14 trillion in starting money supply can be inflationary, depending on what share of that money ends up in consumer hands, how far nominal asset prices fall, how much of that money goes to deleveraging, the degree to which lending multiplies the effect of that new money, and so on. The biggest variable in the near term and intermediate term to monitor for broad consumer price inflation, in my view,
outside of targeted areas of supply chain disruptions, is the total amount of QE-funded money that makes it to Main Street, meaning to the public, as well as their ability to come out of quarantine and spend it. And then for the longer run, the onshoring of supply chains and big infrastructure projects amid a period of deglobalization, if it happens, is something to watch as it pertains to more structural inflation. These are trends I'll be monitoring in the quarters and years ahead. Outside of food, healthcare, and other essentials which have inflationary catalysts at the moment, the trend is likely to be disinflationary for many discretionary goods and services until a large amount of helicopter-like money ends up on Main Street in the form of more checks, negative payroll taxes, considerably extended unemployment benefits, or other stimulus policies. And the probability of those types of policies occurring over the next few years is likely higher than many people think due to how few assets the bottom 50% of the population has and how reliant they are on active income streams. At that point, the possibility for broadly higher consumer price inflation is on the table, and the four-decade period of disinflation from the 1980s to the 2020s will have ended. All right, that concludes QE, MMT, and Inflation and Deflation, a Primer by Lynn Alden. Let's hit, I want to go into as much as I can before I run out of time on this one in the guy's take. Let's hit our sponsor really quick and we will jump back in. The most predictable and stable monetary policy in the world right now is Bitcoin. And the simplest, most predictable way to get allocated is to dollar cost average with Swan Bitcoin. Literally, there's no confusion, there's no panic selling trying to time the market. You buy the flat, you buy the bull, and you buy the dip automatically and regularly with the lowest DCA fees in the business. You set it up once and it just runs. I stack every single week. You can do it monthly, weekly, even daily, and Swan just buys for you and even automatically withdraws it to your own keys. So you are safely and truly owning your own money. And in this environment, I can't really imagine anyone wanting to do anything else. SwanBitcoin.com/guy will even get you $10 free in sats just for starting your plan, and your future self will literally love you dearly for it. So do yourself a favor, start your plan at SwanBitcoin.com/guy. Start stacking sats now. All right, awesome piece from Lynn Alden. Now that we're through the entire thing, I think it all ended up being about an hour and a half worth of audio just on this piece. And it is a little bit old. Obviously, this was published back in quarter one, I think, or quarter two, 2020. So it's cool to actually be able to see a lot of this play out. Like, she was right about essentially where we would be at the end of 2020, roughly. And the obvious fact that that $1,200 check was not the last one and that this is continuing. And it seems to be the case even today that there are continual pushes to get more helicopter money to people. There has been a constant rise in the stimulus. I think the, we can actually check a lot of the different statistics, like M2 money stock has been discontinued since then. So it's a little bit difficult to reasonably measure, but there are still attempts at measuring it. And it's somewhere around 20 trillion, at this point, which is up from 17, I think it was that she said. Money velocity is still really, really low. Which is kind of surprising considering we've actually opened up the economy a lot, but I think it's just the increasing uncertainty and people are really uncomfortable and don't know exactly what to do. So they're hoarding, right? They're scared. Money is the ultimate hedge against uncertainty. So they don't offload it. They deleverage, they get rid of debts. They save whatever they can because they don't know if they're going to have a job. They don't know what the situation is going to be like in a couple of months or years down the road. You know, they're hedging right now, trying to figure out how to make sense of the situation. And debts have continued to actually go up, it appears, across all sectors, which means that the defaults and or the deleveraging has been a little bit short-lived overall. And I'm not sure, I wasn't able to find, and I need to get specifically the public versus private debt. I'm not finding the chart right at this moment, But another thing she was close on was the amount of federal debt, the federal debt to GDP, which is smack dab in the middle of what the estimate was at 130%. Now, what does this all mean for inflation? I think she's right in a general sense when we're talking about the nominal amount of value being put into the, or nominal amount of new dollars being put into the economy and how quickly it gets to Main Street. And she talks about a lot of the deflationary forces at work. And that's a lot of what is going on. That's a lot of what happens during these recessionary periods or during the QE situation, is that a lot of new money is actually created, but there are such deflationary forces at play that what it attempts to do is keep things stable, is to keep things even where they are. But what's funny about that is that where things are is unsustainable. It's keeping things at a level that was already unhealthy, and it's attempting to prevent a correction, prevent a healthy need to wipe out the bad debt, to wipe out the irresponsible companies, to wipe out the overleveraged, to wipe out the unprofitable, to get capital back into the hands of the productive and the responsible in the economy. And these bailouts, these propping up of the system and buying up of the leverage and the bonds and everything for things that explicitly people could not afford, and we know they can't afford because the situation we are in. These corrections, these shifts, are when the money, the capital, is supposed to flow from those that were overleveraged and had irresponsible or bad business behaviors and decisions back to those who were responsible, who saved, who were turning profits, etc. That is what happens in a sound money economy, and that is how you correct for the major mistakes that happen. And something that isn't explicitly talked about in this piece that Lynn doesn't hit, but I think is an important element of this, is that most of the new money creation in the system is actually done through fractional reserve banking, right? And she did talk about this is something that's obviously in numerous of her other pieces, as well as in this one, even though it wasn't kind of dove into explicitly, I think, in this article. But most of the money creation happens not as QE. Again, in the context of our current situation, the QE is there to buy up the bad debt that would be defaulted, that would be deleveraged. They're trying to prevent the debt from being corrected, whereas the fractional reserve system is constantly multiplying the amount of money, is constantly adding new money to the system as debts. So it's specifically low velocity money that's being added to the system that is trickling out and spreading out within the economy. So what's actually happening is during the debt expansion periods, that's really where a lot of the inflation happens. And it concentrates in specific areas of the economy. She mentions healthcare prices have gone up, education prices have gone up, housing prices have gone up, financial assets and the markets have gone up in prices, stocks and equities have gone up in prices. Those are the things that are most purchased with debt. If you just go straight from how the debt is created, where it's created, to the goods that are most purchased with that debt, that's where you end up. So that inflation tends to isolate where the most debt is spent. And that's why you get those exact sorts, those exact industries and goods and assets in the economy. Housing, always purchased with debt. Healthcare, vastly fueled by debt. Also by federal debt, right? There's a ton of federal spending that goes directly to healthcare. So if those are being fueled by deficits, and those deficits are being monetized by either the fractional reserve system increasing or creating new loans out of thin air, and or QE directly monetizing the debt, you're looking at more money chasing the same amount of goods or the same industry, and you bloat the very industry and you have inflation. I mean, I think the entirety of the stock market and the reason that these zombie companies, these unprofitable institutions, are propped up is because of all of this new money chasing it. And what should happen during a recession, what should it, particularly when this is debt-fueled inflation, and in this sense, we're talking about basically both price inflation and nominal new money inflation, inflation in the actual money supply. But what should happen during the deleveraging and the defaulting is that that money supply comes back down to normal, that it actually corrects for the inflation of the previous cycle leading up to where we are. So that deflationary pressure is the correction of the previous inflationary period. And the new money printing, the QE, the MMT, is an attempt to solidify, to cement that inflation into the economy by adjusting the money supply to cover the expansion of the debts in the economy. And what's essentially happening is that they are bailing out the irresponsible and those that indebted themselves to a point that they could not afford at real market interest rates at the expense of the savers and those that who did not go into debt and did not take advantage of it and who now likely got outcompeted by the very institutions that borrowed capital they could not afford and expanded their business on it and now essentially get a lower interest, a even more artificially suppressed interest rate to roll that leverage over into yet another debt instrument or even get some sort of a direct bailout of some sort because of their bad decisions. And explicitly, those companies that did not expand on debt are punished because they explicitly get outcompeted by making the responsible decisions. And the prices of their goods and their factors of production are bid up by those who buy them on debt. A perfect, simple example is somebody trying to buy a house by saving money. Think about if I saved 10% of my income every year, but then the price of a house goes up by 10% every year. Because 99.9% of the people buying a house are doing so with newly created money from nothing. They're issuing debts, they're issuing loans to purchase and bid up the house, the prices of all of these houses. I never get ahead. My actual production of resources in the economy and the saving of that is being destroyed, is being completely negated in the context of my having a home that I own. And all specifically to the benefit of those who aren't saving anything and getting as much of a loan as possible, getting a 99% loan with a 1% down payment on their mortgage, they are the ones who benefit at the expense of my trying to actually save up for my house. So simple example of something that's happening in a pretty widespread fashion. It's how you poison the legitimate allocation of resources across the economy and how you explicitly incentivize bad behavior and even fraud in the banking system and literally reward people, reward financial institutions and banks and huge, huge companies for doing something that is explicitly destructive of resources, of real resources in the economy. I mean, that's what it means to run a deficit, to be constantly running a net negative, to have no profit, is that you are destroying value. That's basically why I think, and you know, Lynn Alden hits this really well, is that there's a lot of different forces at work that prevent the nominal inflation when it comes to the consumer side of things. And when she talks about money not making it to Main Street, this is why you get such lopsided inflation. And essentially the metric, the CPI, is attempting only to measure that which is most visible, that which is right in front of the average consumer. And the idea is, how do we prevent the inflation from getting there? But in a sense, all of these constant price rises, the stock markets, stock market, healthcare, housing, all of these things, this is inflation. That's what is causing this. But because that money is not introducing the introduced into the economy, the new money is not introduced into the economy evenly. It's not distributed among everything, even like we're not using the same number of dollars, new dollars created to buy candy bars as we are to buy houses, is you get this massive distortion in what the market actually wants. The attempt to make sense of the value and the proper allocation of resources in the economy is completely just twisted. It's just poisoned. Because you don't have the same price of money depending on what you are doing or where you are in the economy. The wealthy, the financial assets, They have a supply and price of money that is very, very different from the average consumer with consumer prices. And that's not because of an explicitly different market. That's not because of an actual difference in the supply and demand and the actual productivity or the actual value of these goods. It's because of where they are and how close they are and how they interact with the mechanisms that create new money in the economy. So you bloat everything near the debt machine and everything near the government machine. And they operate as if they are their own economy, as if their currency is a different one than what the normal people, the average citizen, actually uses. And you get these bridges. You get these certain areas where it slowly starts to trickle from one to the other. And the idea is for the government to isolate it. Their task in trying to make it appear as if inflation isn't happening is to make it not trickle, is to make it not spread out. If they can keep it in the financial markets, it just looks like the economy's super healthy and everything's great and growing, when in reality, so many of those companies that continue to increase 20% in their valuations over a handful of years are running net negatives. They are not turning a profit. It is inflation. And she says in this piece, quote, "Bear markets eventually test investor patience for structurally unprofitable businesses if stock price appreciation is the only source of financial payback," end quote. So that's where it is, exactly in recessions and in drawdowns in the market, that these things are supposed to be wiped out, that these things are supposed to be corrected. You're supposed to cut the fat. You're supposed to figure out why it is that you are unprofitable and fix the problem, because that's what it is. A problem. And if you read Jeff, there's so many different deflationary forces at work, and that's kind of what is the dilemma that the entire dollar and the fiat structure has, is that there are so many deflationary forces at work with the technologies, the incredible speed of electronics iterations, and the internet. All software and communications technologies accelerate at an incredible rate, and this is only going to get worse over time, because I think it's going to continue to eat more of the market and become more relevant. More things are going to turn into information technologies rather than less as we move forward. And this is really going to throw a wrench into all of this. There's going to be so many different forces at play, and the balance of money in certain industries or in certain areas where the government spends, where the government monetizes debts specifically with QE and additional new money into the system, and where the Federal Reserve even injects money directly into corporate bonds and equities and these sorts of things, it's only going to distort things further. It's only going to further confuse the natural allocation and measurement of real value across the economy. And then they have the problem of this inflation is starting to trickle down, and Main Street has been so hurt, has been so devastated by this, and has increasingly been paying the price and leading to more and more social unrest from, I mean, the fact that the bottom 50%, I didn't realize how steep that decline was, from 4% in the 1990s to 1.5%. And I expect it to continue to fall as far as the total household net worth. That's a decline of like, 62.5%. That's a huge decline. That's a huge ratio loss in the amount of value and capital actually allocated by the bottom 50% of the United States. No wonder social unrest and populism has increased so much in the last, 5 to 10 years in this country. And this is why the reaction is to try to give money directly to Main Street. And this is a never-ending game. There's no real way to roll this back, because the only way to actually correct for these mistakes is get real prices, and they're having to manipulate prices to keep the thing from correcting. So the very problem that they're having to fix is the one that they have created, and their only solution, their only quote-unquote temporary way out of this, is to extend and exaggerate the very cause, the very root cause of the issue. But something that she talks about in this piece very briefly, but I think may actually be the leading factor as to what sort of inflation we get in the next 5 to 10 years, is really the confidence in the dollar. And she talks about this, that this is going to be one of the leading indicators or leading factors as to the worth of a fiat currency. I mean, she says, quote, fiat currency is ultimately a confidence game. And MMT exposes that that's exactly what is happening. That MMT makes it so clear that that's all this is. And the facade of this push and pull, this check and balance of we have to have savings, we have to pull the money from somewhere else in order to actually have debt, is falling away. And she has another quote that, I'll just go ahead and read it. Quote, whether monetary and fiscal policies result in significant consumer price inflation or not, depends on where the money is spent, the magnitude of that spending, what other inflationary or deflationary forces are occurring to fight with or against it, and whether people have confidence in the soundness of the currency. That last line, whether people have confidence in the soundness of the currency. So she does a brilliant job of laying out the fiscal policies, the potential fiscal policies going forward, the monetary policies that will change, that we can expect. And what's funny is about three quarters on now, she's basically been right on the money. The magnitude of it, the other potential inflationary or deflationary forces that are at play, which are pretty staggering. We have a lot of deflationary forces because debt is being wiped from the system, which is the removal of monetary supply. Like I talked about, you know, most the loans created in a fractional reserve system are loans out of thin air. They are new money entered into the system. So the deleveraging of those loans is actually the actual destruction of the supply of money in the spendable economy. But the one factor that we really can't know anything about and we cannot time, we don't know when or how this happens, is the confidence in the soundness of the currency. And this is the big question, is when inflation starts to move in the dollar, how will it shake confidence in the United States, in the dollar system? It may actually be more effectual than even mild inflation in a less important currency, because the world is so dependent on it, it could shake things very quickly and in a big way to see 5%, 8% inflation. And in the next year or two, I don't think it's totally out of the question, considering a lot of the forces that Lynn Alden lays out and the potential consequences of these things and how they affect the perception of the dollar's security, of the dollar being that hedge against uncertainty. And the slow move away that we've seen, Lynn Alden has another great piece on the fraying of the petrodollar system, indicating or showing exactly how the world has been slowly moving away and trying to get off the petrodollar standard and what we could see going forward. So that's one that I've also read on the show, so it is available in audio. I highly recommend checking that one out too, because she does a good job of taking this exact principle, this exact idea, and expanding on it a lot, and doing the very thorough analysis and breakdown of the actual numbers to put concrete information on top of this. But I think one of the best quotes that she has in this that I think is the thing in my mind that is top to concern about in regards to consumer price inflation, in regards to the security and sustainability of the U.S. economy or the dollar economy, is, quote, with all of this money printing likely to occur over the next several years, the possibility for consumer price inflation becomes a matter of money velocity and confidence in the dollar. Those are the two big things, in my opinion. Money velocity is likely to increase now that things are finally beginning to open back up and the economy's starting to kick back into gear. People are starting to do things again, go on vacations, go out to restaurants and events, et cetera, et cetera. These things are starting to slowly move again. I think that will continue to increase money velocity. I don't think we have quarter one metrics of any sort during the first of 2021 yet, but all of 2020 was very, very low monetary velocity. I think that velocity will start to increase quite a bit, and I think that will be really bad for exactly this sort of stuff. And then lastly is the confidence in the dollar and the vast amount of money overseas, of dollar holdings, of dollar denominated debts, of bonds and equities held overseas, and what that could mean if the confidence in that system, in the dollar system, begins to shake. Which is funny because during global recessions, like crises like this, you actually see the dollar gain in confidence, but I don't think it's sustained. And I think the crisis, the quote-unquote uncertainty in the markets start to reel back in, you get an accelerated effect on the then disconnect from the dollar. You know, I think it's a two steps forward, one step back sort of thing. And the dollar's actually benefited a lot from the destruction and the massive uncertainty in so many other currencies. And the fact that the dollar remains the world reserve makes it yet again the best hedge, or the most accessible and most liquid hedge, for so many different economies across or around the globe. Like it's a whole lot easier for people in Venezuela to shift right over to the dollar than it is to attempt to find some alternative or better, or you know, invest in something new like Bitcoin. The dollar is going to be the one that they run to when the Venezuelan currency goes belly up or starts showing really incredible, like really strong signs of weakness. And then same thing with Argentina and Libya and everything else. As these smaller, more isolated national currencies start to crumble, people will rush to the global reserve. So it will actually entrench that, and I think we've kind of seen this, is that it entrenches the dollar during these crises. But then as we get on the other side of the crisis and there are less people running for the exits to currency B, C, and D, they will start to let go of A. They will start to let go of the dollar, which means it's very possible that supply comes flooding back into the system slowly over time. It starts to increase that flood back towards the US or back to the sell side of the currency. And then if at the same time, the petrodollar, the oil and energy trade between nations, starts to slowly deviate away from the dollar, or from countries actually holding government U.S. treasuries on their balance sheets, if that demand starts to fall at the exact same time, and then you have the outflow of the artificial and temporary increase in demand during something like the COVID crisis, and at the exact same time, you have massive amounts of new money printing, you have the attempt to monetize all of this new debt, this new QE, this even MMT and helicopter money, trying to mitigate the deflationary forces. What you could end up doing is accelerating the inflationary forces on the other side of this to a degree that there's no ability to catch it or cut it off as it starts to roll. And then as the confidence in the dollar starts to shake, that's when we're in a place where I feel like we don't really know what's going to happen, because there is such, and maybe it's nothing, you know, maybe it will still, any sort of currency crisis or confidence loss in fiat currency may still end up benefiting the dollar overall, because so many other countries are in the same situation. So many countries are having this problem run at the exact same time that the U.S. is having all of these problems and all of these policies. So maybe this is still a much longer time frame, but I think it's important not to discount or remove the simple factor of how people perceive the future of the dollar and the confidence in the dollar as the global reserve, and how greatly that can affect inflation even outside of all of the monetary and fiscal policy that's going on. Because there are way, way more dollars and way more dollar-denominated assets and goods and, you know, the dependence of oil, the OPEC nations only selling in dollars. There are so many external factors, global and foreign factors, that can have a huge, huge impact on domestic price inflation. So when taking bringing a step back and taking a long-term overarching image of where we are in the state of the world, where we are in the state of these debt super cycles, and what the global state of the financial system and the Western world really is. I'm thinking about the utter lack of guarantees and the arbitrary nature of monetary policy and fiscal state of the U.S. government and the global reserve currency, not to mention all of the other fiat currencies that are largely in the same situation. The truth is, all we can really do is guess. We have no idea how even just seeing a potential 20% deficit GDP to GDP ratio for a year will affect the global confidence in holding dollars. We don't know how bad the rate of QE and MMT-like policies will be in the coming years. We have no clue, really, what the amount of dollars will be in the near or far future. So taking that long-term time frame and considering Bitcoin in this environment, when it comes to the monetary guarantees of the system, I know exactly what the Bitcoin monetary policy is in 10 years. A truly sound money in this environment will increasingly steal that underlying base of uncertainty, the hedge against that uncertainty, because Bitcoin is profound certainty when it comes to monetary stability in an increasingly uncertain environment where confusion and the lack of guarantees are escalating. They are getting worse, and the assurances are continually decreasing. Unprecedented policies are basically the norm these days, and Bitcoin is a powerful underlying totem to relate, to compare to that, to see just how uncertain, just how frivolous that environment is, how fickle those quote-unquote monetary guarantees are. Now, the ignorance and misunderstanding around money, I think, will continue to make this transition very slow. And then in addition, particularly in the Western world, in the modern world, where people aren't suffering nearly as much from a lot of these policies or the consequences of them, where, you know, just in the context of like the upper middle class is seeing this as like a huge technological explosion and they're benefiting massively from the increase in asset prices and the financial market growth. I think with Bitcoin and quote-unquote crypto in general, the hype cycle of thinking that this is tech, that these are fancy new networks and app stores with gadgets, I think it will also cloud out in the short to medium term what the real strength of the monetary base is. But in the long term, this will simply continue to show how unbelievably stable and secure Bitcoin is as a new global base money. And in an environment, a global environment of subjective, manipulated, and highly unpredictable money, Bitcoin will continue to be that black hole that will just keep growing and sucking more and more value out of the fiat system. And I think it will become the native currency of the internet, and I think it will slowly transition to a medium of exchange and unit of account. Not necessarily quickly in the context of like a couple of years, but insanely quickly in the context of past monetary transitions. I think the presence of the internet, the presence of this being a software system and a protocol, I think in the grand scheme, adoption and acceptance, integration of this system into our global monetary and financial systems has the potential to be very shocking. So I will just be watching this dollar inflation and or deflation dilemma, this debacle unfold while I stack more Bitcoin every week using Swan Bitcoin and withdraw it securely to my BitBox hardware wallet. I don't have to be connected to this. I'm just a spectator at this point. You know, I am in the dollar economy, but I want no part of that game in any and all possible ways that I can avoid being a player. Any way that I can exit the game, I am taking. And the most powerful exit is to hold your own keys and dollar cost average, regularly buy and save Bitcoin. And a shout out to our sponsors for providing exactly those tools for me to exit, because the dollar system, the fiat system, increasingly, every time I learn more and more about it and think about it, really in the context of comparing it to the revolutionary tool that we have at our disposal now, the utter common sense that Bitcoin is makes the insanity of the fiat system just seem like such a shit show to me. Shout out to my sponsors for the tools, and then also for sponsoring the podcast, keeping the show alive for me and everyone who finds value in Bitcoin Audible. So thank you guys for listening. Don't forget to check out our sponsors at guyswann.com. Subscribe to the show so you don't miss it. We got so many great pieces coming this week, and there is so much happening. I'm going to Childerberg this weekend, and then Bitcoin Miami, or Bitcoin 2021 conference in Miami next weekend. It's going to be a crazy few weeks. Hopefully I can still kind of get my normal schedule of stuff out. And I hope to meet a lot of you in both of those places. But follow me on Twitter if you want to find out more. Hopefully I'll be able to publish from afar, and I will stay up on all this crazy stuff going on. Thank you guys so much for listening. This is Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swann, and until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. This has been a 111 production, and you were listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.